with this initiative. So this week, we're continuing our sermon series called The Easter Experience, and we've been going through so far the different stages of the last several hours of Jesus' life and asking the question, what if what happened then changes everything for my life now? And we've been looking at different elements of Jesus' last dinner with his disciples, his followers, with his betrayal, with his trial. And now we continue in our series that we're also going through as small groups meeting in homes. And as I've said every week, if you haven't joined a small group yet, there's always a chance to join because these each week kind of are their own self-contained lessons. So if you missed last week's or even the first 2 or 3 weeks, you're not going to be left behind. And you're always welcome to join a group. But today, this week, the series, the video series that we're going along with is portraying Jesus' path to the cross. And he actually, Kyle Eidelman is the name of the man that designed the curriculum, follows Jesus through the streets of Jerusalem as he makes his way to Golgotha, which is called the place of the skull. And this is a place designed for a couple of things. It's right outside the city of Jerusalem, which is the capital city of Israel at the time, and is designed for maximum impact. Because you see, Romans didn't crucify every criminal. Romans crucified certain kinds of criminals to make an example of them. And so they intentionally chose places for this execution to maximize the impact. So it was always in busy areas where travelers had to go by these places. And so Golgotha would have been one of those kinds of places, a place of maximum impact, because the goal was a deterrent. If you don't want to end up like this sorry man, then don't do what this sorry man did. And sometimes they would place a plank with the crime written on it. And it was often meant for thieves, for murderers, for insurrectionists. Anyone that led a revolution against the Roman Empire would always end up on a cross overlooking the city for the people and the inhabitants of that city and that area to know. And to see and to know that if they did the same thing, this would be how they would end up. And so Jesus is making his way through what tradition calls the Via Dolorosa. Now, we don't actually know for certain. There is a Via Dolorosa still in Jerusalem. In fact, if you went there, you could actually go along what is considered the traditional route that they believe Jesus took. Now, we don't actually know for certain, because Jerusalem was sacked, was destroyed by the Romans about 60 years following Jesus' birth in about AD 60, but then was destroyed again for good measure about 100 years after that. So we honestly don't know what that looks like and what that route was. But what we know is that as Jesus was led down the first century equivalent to the Green Mile, the Romans wanted to add insult to injury and pain to the already excruciating experience that they have been going through. And so they add a crossbeam to the shoulders of the condemned, big, heavy beams that would complete the cross that was already in the ground, and they would strap it often or just place it on the shredded back of the men that were headed to Golgotha. And they would force them to try to drag this, whether it was on their shoulders, sometimes it would fall behind them and they would try to drag it. Often they couldn't. In fact, if you know the story of Jesus, you know that he is so weakened, both physically and I'm sure emotionally and spiritually, that he can't even lift the cross that is placed on his back. And so he is forced, after the scourging, after the humiliation, to carry his cross. And this week it's interesting. Some of you that are part of the Sunday school that watched this video this morning, You know that Kyle actually goes through and sees the final hours of Jesus' life through the eyes of his mother, Mary. And it's an interesting juxtaposition showing Mary as a young girl and her angelic encounter and the prophecy of Jesus' birth and his early years getting lost in the temple, and even theorizes what life may have been like for Jesus as the stepson of a carpenter. And as I was thinking about that experience, it started to kind of get me thinking about what the devastating impact of these events must have had on those who were closest to Jesus. John 19 actually tells us that there were several people, several supporters that were still with Jesus and still near to him. Interestingly enough, most of them were women. At the foot of the cross, we know that Jesus' mother Mary, her sister, was there. Mary Magdalene, whom we're familiar with from the story of Jesus. And then another Mary, just to round out the naming scheme, were all there. If you think that Catholics call their children Mary, there's a reason for this. Mary is a very common name in Jesus' day. And so it's kind of a throwback honoring those who stayed with Jesus even as his followers, his closest disciples, deserted him. Luke 23 actually tells us that in the midst of a hostile crowd, there was a small but vocal minority that openly wept as Jesus was forced to walk through the streets of Jerusalem and watch him suffer. And as I reread the description of Jesus' beating and humiliation and his final steps, I keep coming back to what must that have felt like for those who followed him? What must have been going through their mind on Jesus' final journey to Golgotha? Jesus had been the hope of these people. He had brought hope to a hopeless situation. You see, Rome was one who was very good at destroying the hope of the people that they conquered. Their whole goal was to convince those under their rule that there was no way out, that this was life, this was all there was to it. But Jesus had offered a new hope, a new way of thinking, a new spark that may light a fire. And so these people created a new identity around this man. In fact, this man, Jesus, had given not just hope in a theoretical sense, but had actually literally healed some of these people and given them hope to live a life, had given them new identity, had delivered them from bondage, both spiritual and physical. Through this entire ordeal, they were no doubt praying, begging God to deliver this man that they believed to be a Messiah. You see, Messiahs were not new. Throughout centuries and almost a millennia of hardship by Israel, whether it was because of their slavery in Egypt, or their exile in Babylon, or the rise of Greece and Rome to rule over them forcibly, they had been looking and searching and waiting and hoping for a coming Messiah that God had promised. And many had risen up and claimed that they were the promised Messiah. They would rise up armies. They would rise up teachings. They would rise up support. And every single time, their words would be betrayed by their death. You see, up until now, death meant that the Messiah was not who he claimed to be. And so all their hope in a system that may, in theory, vindicate the innocent God-sent rabbi, any safeguard that the system allowed for had failed utterly, and the corruption of those who were in charge were revealed. And now, on this day, the one in whom they had put their hope, and the one that had given them hope when they had never experienced it, maybe in their entire lives, was being dragged through the streets as a criminal to be put to death in the way that somebody would if they had led a revolution or created an uprising, if they had only known. Messiahs were not meant to die. And as Jesus was led to his execution that day, it seemed that everything that the people believed in would die with Jesus. And ultimately, their prayers would go unanswered. Jesus would not be spared that day. There would be nothing that could change that outcome. On this day, for those people, all of their hope was lost. And they had to have asked themselves the question, where was God in this? Why is God not doing something? And from a certain point of view, the story of that fateful Friday, the day that we now call Good Friday, is one of unanswered prayers. If you go back to the Garden of Gethsemane, when Jesus spends his final day, hour with his disciples before he is betrayed, he tells his followers to keep watch while he goes and prays. And three times he collapses on the ground and speaks to his Father. In fact, he says in Matthew 26, 38, "My soul is crushed with grief to the point of death." And you know, sometimes it's interesting when we talk about Jesus and we talk about his garden experience. Sometimes I think we overlook how Jesus did not want to go through with it. Not that he didn't want to save humanity, but he hoped and prayed and pleaded. In fact, he says, "My God, if there is any other way, if it is at all possible, please let this cup of suffering be taken from me." And he says it three times. And reading scholars and commentaries, because I don't know the Greek, I'll be honest, but the way that they construct this in the original Greek meant that the author believes that Jesus prayed this prayer in full belief that God could change the outcome. That God could take this cup of suffering away. That God could make a change, that God could deliver Jesus from this fate. And as tears fall from his eyes and sweat mixes with blood pouring from his pores, we learn that Jesus hurts like we hurt. That Jesus, knowing what would happen to him, knowing the fate that awaited him, not just the physicalness. I believe, like Kyle Eidelman believes in this series he taught, I don't believe it was the physical pain that he was afraid of. I believe it was the weight of the guilt and the shame that would be placed on his soul for the sin of humanity that he knew was coming. But that day, God said no. God did not answer the prayer of Jesus. In fact, what we see in the story of Jesus' death is that sometimes unanswered prayer is in itself a miracle, which for some of us is not exactly great news when you're in the midst of it. And I understand that, and it's not always easy, because the story of that first Easter is not an easy story. And sometimes people will try to tell you that this is an easy story to understand and an easy story to embrace. But sometimes God is not as easy to understand as I would like. And too often I struggle when God doesn't come through when I ask him for something. And I struggle, and maybe you struggle too, not just in the little ways, not just when I'm driving through Plattsburgh and there's a red light coming and I know it, and there's a series of red lights and I'm already late and God doesn't miraculously change the lights to green. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when you plead with God. Notice that Jesus did not simply ask God for something in passing, but that he fervently and passionately and with his whole heart poured to his Father. And God still said no. And perhaps for you, you've been in that place. Maybe you're there now. Maybe you haven't been, but you know people that have. And maybe you are struggling with consistent migraines and you've been praying maybe for years, God, please, I want this migraine to be gone. And it's just for whatever reason, it's not going away. Or maybe you've been searching for a job and you haven't been able to find it. And you've been coming to him and you've been saying, God, please, I need this job. But yet day after day, the phone does not ring. Or maybe you've been sick and you've been asking for healing again and again and again, and yet here you are, you're still sick, you're still in pain, and you wonder, where is God in all of this? What do you do when God says no? What do you do when you're a sincere follower of Jesus and you ask him in sincerity with what you would classify as a pure heart for something, and God doesn't grant you the desires of your heart? It's one of the most difficult elements for me of the Christian life, but I believe that there is still hope, even in the unanswered prayer. Because when you see the story like Jesus' story, and you see the sea of unanswered prayers, you see that throughout the no's, God is still at work. You see throughout the no's, you see that God is weaving together all of these things for good. And if you have your Bibles, we're going to be looking at another passage of Scripture from 2 Corinthians chapter 12 that also, I believe, speaks hope into our lives even when God says no. I believe this gives us hope, and we learn some things about prayer, even in these difficult times, even in the midst of long, unanswered prayers. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 7, it's going to be on the overheads. It's also in the Bible app that's on the App Store, both for Apple and Google, if you want to follow along. 2 Corinthians 12, starting in verse 7, this is the Apostle Paul writing. He says, "So to keep me from becoming proud, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger from Satan to torment me and to keep me from becoming proud. Three different times I begged the Lord to take it away, and each time he said, 'My grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness.' So now I am glad to boast about my weakness, so that the power of Christ can work through me. That's why I take pleasure in my weakness and in insults and hardships and persecutions and troubles that I suffer for Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong." You know, a guy like Paul is an interesting story to tell. You see, he was one who was a religious leader before he met Jesus. In fact, he was known as one of the foremost opponents of those who called themselves Christians, those who called themselves followers of Jesus. In fact, the first person executed for his faith was executed under the nodding approval of this man who was born Saul but changed his name to Paul after he began to follow Jesus. Following a miraculous conversion when he encountered Jesus after he died and rose again and returned to heaven, he encountered a physical manifestation of Jesus on the road and miraculously and emphatically gave his heart and his life to Jesus and began serving Jesus. But he paid a price for it. He paid a heavy price. In fact, he will tell you of the beatings that he underwent by those who opposed him, of the times he was starved, of the times he was shipwrecked or placed in prison, when he had huge stones thrown at him and he was left for dead. In fact, he talked about being beaten 39 times because Jews believed that 40 lashes would kill you, but 39 was the magic number. And this happened to him 5 times. And so sometimes I look at the story of Paul and think, you know, if I was God, which is a dangerous statement, by the way, I would be tempted to give him what he's asking for. Because doesn't he deserve it? Look at all that he has gone through. Now, if somebody had done that for me, I would be inclined to throw them a bone. But here, it doesn't happen. And we learn something early in his story about prayer, and that is this. Prayer isn't about getting our way, but it's about surrendering our will. Prayer isn't about getting our way, it's about surrendering our will. When I share Jesus' prayer of desperation in Matthew 26, I intentionally neglected to share the conclusion that Jesus brings. Each time he frantically calls out to his Father for deliverance, he ends with the same type of refrain. My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but as you will. Verse 42 of Matthew 26 says, My Father, if it is not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done. He knew what was coming. He knew the agony that awaited him. And yet Jesus knew in the end that he had to surrender his will so that the Father's will could be done. Jesus even taught us to pray, Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. A friend of mine who's planting a church in Buffalo, one of the catchphrases he has on a t-shirt that he's selling for support says, As Buffalo as it is in heaven. Maybe we can co-opt that as in Katyville as it is in heaven. True prayer isn't about getting God to do what I want. It's about surrendering our will to God, regardless of the outcome. And this portion of Scripture, 2 Corinthians 12, is challenging because Paul is talking. He says that to the reason that he was given this thorn in his flesh, he calls it a messenger from Satan, was in order to keep him from being conceited or in order to keep him from becoming proud. And that's a tough one because God allows this messenger from Satan, this thorn in his flesh. It doesn't just happen. God allows it and he uses it to keep him from being conceited. Now, we don't know what it was. Most people, most scholars believe that this was manifest in some kind of physical ailment. Perhaps it was blinding migraines. Perhaps it was some form of epilepsy or even a speech impediment. Some actually suggest that he was partially or mostly blind because there's a portion when he actually writes one of his letters and he writes it in his own hand. Usually he'd get a scribe to do it, somebody else to write on his behalf while he dictated. And he actually says, notice I'm writing with really large letters. Now, I can imagine if you've ever written without your glasses on, if you need it to see things that are close, you probably know how big the letters have to be for you to be able to read it. But whatever it is, we know that it was something that he would describe as torment. And maybe you're here and you identify with Paul's description of the thorn in his flesh. Maybe you have something in your life that is tormenting you. Maybe it is a physical ailment like we assume Paul had. Maybe it's migraines or arthritis or fibromyalgia. Maybe it's an injury that's lingering and just won't go away. Maybe it's psychological anxiety or depression. Maybe it is a person. Maybe it's a person that opposes you at every turn and makes your life awful and that just torments you again and again and knows just how to press your buttons. And maybe you've prayed about it. Maybe you've pleaded with God, begging him to take it away. God, please change this. Maybe you've experienced those moments of grief like Jesus did in the garden where you've begged for deliverance. But God hasn't changed your situation. How do you pray in moments like this? How do you pray when God has said no? What do you do? How do you react? Well, Jesus in his shoes said, God, not my will, but yours be done. And Paul, in fact, rejoiced when he looks back at what God did because of the pain he endured, not in spite of it. What's important to remember is that prayer is not about getting your way, but surrendering your will. But Paul also teaches us something else about prayer. He teaches us that prayer reminds us that we aren't in control, but it keeps us close to the one who is. It's not about us being in control, but prayer keeps us close to the one that is. The thorn in Paul's life proved to him that he can't control his life. And you know, there's something almost freeing when you realize you can't control everything. Because there's something about the need to control and the need to clearly define your whole life that makes life difficult. And some of us never learn that we can't control everything, and we struggle and strain and stress over it. But sometimes it's freeing to know that we can't be in control and surrender ourselves to the one who is. In 2 Corinthians 12:8, again, he says that three times he pleaded with God to take his thorn away from him. He pleaded with God, knowing that nothing that he could do would change the situation. It was something only God could do. He could work and work and work and go and see doctors. In fact, one of his good friends, a man named Luke, who wrote the third gospel and wrote the book of Acts, and in the book of Acts you see that he was one of Paul's closest companion, was a doctor by trade. And even though medicine was somewhat rudimentary back in Jesus' day, he had to know that doctors couldn't help him. And so he begged God, pleaded. And these weren't just these little prayers that he says in short succession. These are seasons of prayer, seasons of time that he bowed on his face before God and pleaded with him to remove this from him. Maybe you're in a season like that right now. Maybe you have pleaded with God to save your marriage. Maybe you've prayed, God, please hold it together. Maybe you're pleading for your health. You're in constant pain, and you just want some rest, and so you've pled with God, please, please take this pain away. Maybe it's financial. Please, God, I need a job, or God, I need some help. The amount of money I need far outweighs the amount of money I have. Maybe it's prayer for a loved one. They're sick and you're pleading, God, please save them. And that's where Paul was. Now, for me, again, I see Paul and all that he's done and his faithfulness. And my first thought is, God, give him what he's asking for. But how does God respond? Check out 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. Paul relays God's response when he said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. You know, on the surface, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense, really. On this one, it's asking for God's deliverance, and God's saying, no, my grace is enough. But God, I'm in pain. No, my grace is enough. But God, I need this job. I need the money. No, my grace is enough. But God, I need your help. I need you to change this for me. No, my grace is enough. And if you look at the word grace from the Greek, it's called the word charis, and it's used 155 times. And one of the sources I love to use, because I don't know a lick of Greek, is Strong's Concordance, and it's actually available on the internet. It's all over the place. There's an amazing description of this word charis. And it says this, it's up on the screen behind me. It says, grace is when God freely extends himself, leaning and reaching to us because he is disposed to bless and be near us. It's God freely extending himself, leaning and reaching to us because he is disposed to bless and be near us. Grace is God leaning in and saying, I am here for you. I love you. I am enough. Don't rely on me just because what I can do for you or what I can offer to you. Lean on me. Let me be your strength. And it's hard to explain to somebody that has never experienced it. But I can tell you that there are times in my life where somebody will ask me, how did you make it through? And I can't explain it other than saying it was God 100%. And I don't know how else to explain it other than that. How in the world are you surviving, doing what you're doing? I don't know. It is but by the grace of God. But in the presence of God, at that moment, his grace was enough. We need to recognize that prayer isn't about getting our way. It's about surrendering our will. But we have to understand that prayer is also about trusting, not asking. It's about trusting in God, not asking for our way. Sometimes we get this mixed up in Western Christianity, especially in America, where we are so focused on getting stuff, and our whole culture is very stuff-focused. And so when we don't get what we want from a company or from an organization, and sometimes a church, we say we'll go where we can get what we need. And often we treat God that way too. We treat him as if he's Santa here for our pleasure. As long as we're good, we'll get what we want. But prayer has never been about asking. Even though it's true, there is a measure of asking in prayer. But it's not the point. The point is about learning to trust in God. And that's what Paul had to learn, this weakness that he is talking about, this thorn in his flesh, this ailment that he faced on a daily basis, this terrible thing that would not go away. It happened to him again and again and again. And he had to start to learn that his prayer wasn't about God giving him what he wanted, but it was about learning to trust that God heard and God answered, and that God was going to do something more than what he understood. In verses 9 and 10 of 2 Corinthians 12, I love this. He says, therefore, I will boast all the more in my weakness, so that the power of Christ may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and in insults and in hardships and persecutions and in difficulties. And I cannot stress the importance of that last sentence enough. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Understand that Paul, when he is looking at his life, and he is seeing the difficulties that he has undergone and the times that he has begged for relief and begged for deliverance, he looks back and sees that even at his weakest point, God is at his strongest. And that is still how it is today. When we are at our weakest, God is at his strongest. Paul is saying that even in the midst of weakness and insults and hardness and persecution and difficulties, he can delight in these things. An odd thing to consider for us, but he delights in them. The things that he'd never choose to undergo under his own auspices. He'd never choose these things, but he delights in them, knowing that he experiences the presence and the power of God in those things. You know, it's often not our successes that draw me closer to God. It's the times when I can't depend on anything else but God that help me to know that He is there and to reach a level of intimacy that I'd never experience otherwise. When you're faced with no other options, God is able to come through in ways that you would never expect. When I am weak, I can experience God's power in a way that I would never imagine. So then I can delight in my own weakness. I tell you, when I first started out in ministry, I look back at my first church. I was there for 3 years, and that was an incredibly difficult situation. When we first got married, my wife is an American. She's from Syracuse. I'm Canadian from the East Coast. And when we got married, she moved up to be with me. And she actually went to school in Canada. She was on a visitor's visa for students. And so we were going to, at some point, get her a permanent residency because we were married. But my first church, I did not make a whole lot of money. In fact, I remember looking back at my budgets from that year. I'm a budgeter. I stress if the budget doesn't add up the way I want it to. That's just how I'm predisposed. And I remember looking and seeing a lot of red ink on the budget. We went to this church with a little bit of savings. I worked really hard for a year. Worked 70, 80-hour weeks to save up. And we went there, and I fully expected in the time that I was there to end up in debt. There was a lot of expenses that I just couldn't get out of. We were both students. We had to pay our student loan bills. We had to have a vehicle, and we had to pay for it somehow. We had to eat, not well, but we had to eat something. And if you've ever shopped in Canada, you'll understand that groceries are not exactly cheap in Canada. They're good, they're just not cheap. And I tell you, at the end of those years, I fully and completely expected to be significantly in debt because they did not line up. The amount of my expenses outstripped and outweighed the amount of my income. And for that first year, my wife couldn't work. And even when she could, we lived in a town of about 1,200. That was about 20 minutes from the nearest community. So there wasn't exactly a lot of jobs available in Perth Andover, New Brunswick. So she got a job, but it wasn't paying enough. She got another job that paid more, but ended up cutting a lot of her hours. So most of those 3 years were a strain and a struggle. And I'll be honest, it was awful. It was stressful, and I felt isolated and alone. But when I look back on that time, and I look at those 3 years, and I walk away from that season of my life, something amazes me, because I didn't walk away in debt. I didn't walk away with a zero balance in my bank account and money on my credit cards. And I had a little bit in savings, and I don't know why. I can't really explain it. In fact, I remember at one point when we moved away, I thought we were getting a security deposit back, but we weren't. That's a whole story. It's not worth sharing, but I thought we were going to get an extra like $500, and at the time, I thought this would be the thing that gets us through. We never got that, but somehow, and I can't explain it other than that it was God, somehow we walked away from that unscathed. Somehow, we walked away from that financially okay. Somehow, God got us through. And I can't explain it any other way with any other explanation other than God was in it. And God got us through. And it was His grace that sustained me. And that when I was weak, His strength carried me. And this morning, maybe you're in that kind of place. Maybe you're like Paul, and there's an affliction in your life. Maybe you're like me and you're overwhelmed by all that is going on around you, and you feel like you're going to get swallowed up by the waves. Maybe you just wish that God would deliver you, but maybe in this moment, maybe in this time, you need to be reminded that God's grace is enough, and that when you are at your weakest, God is at his strongest. This morning, God has grace for you. The same great grace that saved you is the grace that can sustain you and strengthen you. It's the grace of God, a grace that allows you to lean on him when you're at your weakest, when you're at your breaking point, when you don't think you can go on. This is the grace that God offers. And we can trust him because he is one that will hold you and sustain you. And he is working all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. I'm going to ask the worship team to come back up. We're going to close our time together with a song. And the song is called Good, Good Father. And I felt like it was an appropriate way to end our service, because in the midst of these times of hurt and fear, that even though things get messy and things get difficult, that God is still at work and that God is still good and God still cares and God's still doing things in your life and that God hasn't given up on you. So don't give up on God.